Be seated, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in the final case. It's 11-0732, In Re Stephanie Lee.
The court, Mr. Rothenberg, will present argument for the relator. Relator is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The question presented by this original proceeding is whether a trial court has discretion to refuse to grant judgment on a mediated settlement agreement in the absence of any evidence of family violence which caused one or the other of the parties to that agreement to enter into the agreement when otherwise he or she would not have.
That sounds too simplistic. So you're asking that the trial judge not look into the order in this one? It looks like one of the parties is a sex offender.
I'm not asking that at all, Your Honor. I think the legislature is asking that in the statute, and that's why I was going to go into the provisions of this statute. If the court, before we get to the portion that applies to this case, let's look at the portion that doesn't apply. It has to do with arbitrations. It's right above the section that applies to this case in section 153-0071. There, the legislature instructed that if parties enter into binding arbitrations in family law cases, the trial court shall enter judgment on the arbitrator's order unless the trial court determines that that arbitrator's order is not in the best interest of the child. The legislature, not Scott Rothenberg, determined that in the case of binding arbitration, we need the family courts to supervise and oversee when a stranger to the family of the child that's in question makes binding decisions about that child and that child's best interest. The legislature, not Scott Rothenberg, gave the family courts of this state the authorization, not only the authorization, but the duty to determine whether that arbitration agreement is in the best interest of the child. Now we turn to mediated settlement agreements. The reason I started with arbitration is because the language that the legislature chose for arbitration orders is very different than the language that the legislature chose for mediated settlement agreements. As to mediated settlement agreements, the legislature said that a party to a mediated settlement agreement in a family law case shall be entitled to judgment on that mediated settlement agreement unless, and here are the three clauses, one, that there was family violence, two, that family violence caused that party to enter into the agreement when otherwise they would not have, and that's the most important word today, and three, that the agreement is not in the best interest of the child.
So you think the legislature then said it is permissible for a mediated settlement agreement to be not in the best interest of the child because of neglect, for example, and the trial court has no discretion to disturb an agreement that is clearly not in the child's best interest. That's fine.
It is, and I think the answer to why that's fine, even though in my capacity as a parent, I'm disturbed by that, As an advocate in the system of civil justice, I'm not. The judgment is not the be-all and end-all of protecting and taking care of a child. As Your Honor knows, there are criminal statutes in terms of what happens if a child suffers or is threatened with potential abuse. We have Children's Protective Services. We have emergency orders for the child court. There are a number of different remedies that can come in after a mediated settlement agreement is turned into the judgment if it turns out that in fact
if the child survives during that time. I mean, we're talking about sending a child to somebody who is on record. The hypothetical is neglecting the child, either nutrition or otherwise, leaving the child home alone. And even if it's for one day, the rest of the family code says the courts are supposed to be guided by what's in the best interest of the child. It seems to me that that best interest determination that oversees the whole family code conflicts with a provision that says the child's best interest doesn't matter in some circumstances.
May I ask something?
I'd like an answer to that question first, please.
I think the answer is If the court is concerned about that, as I am, we ought to be the first 10 people online when the legislature opens for bill filing for the next session and suggest to the legislature that maybe this isn't the best idea. But in our system of government, if the legislature, as a matter of public policy, says mediated settlement agreements are so important to this system, and getting these cases out of the pipeline is so important, and they said this in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, I believe it's chapter 154.002, that we have to weigh and balance the safety of this child and the potential of risk to this child, giving mind to the fact that there are other remedies to protect this child, versus getting a huge number of these cases out of the system early.
What's the other remedy to protect the child here?
On the threat or risk or fear of any sort of injury that's credible, Children's Protective Services can be called. An emergency order from the family court can be requested. So the police can be called.
So in this instance, Judge Dean didn't have any discretion to make that determination in the first instance?
I have never been one to tell judges what they can and cannot do. I'm simply here as an advocate in the system.
Well, as you read the statute, I mean, that's what your interpretation is.
It's not an interpretation, it's the plain word of the statute. The legislature said shall be entitled. I don't think there's any room for disagreement about what that means.
Oh, sure there is. I mean, case law is full, which sometimes shall means shall, and sometimes it shall not mean shall.
Okay. Well, then that brings us to the next question of whether under this particular circumstance, the agreement in question results in an absurd result. Is it absurd to allow a parent to have visitation with a child under a situation where that parent and a registered sex offender have both agreed under threat of jail for contempt of court that the registered sex offender will not be allowed within 5 miles of that child any time that that parent has visitation with the child?
And there, one additional fact, has violated that requirement.
Right. Has not violated that, with all due respect, Justice Heck, has not violated that requirement because that requirement was not in place at the time of the contact between the minor and that adult pre the mediation agreement.
It wasn't a violation of his probation?
If it were credible and if there were evidence of it, then yes. But I want to be clear, the child did not testify that this occurred. Benjamin, the father, did not testify that he was present when this occurred. The father was testifying with no evidentiary basis, did not say, I was told by so-and-so, I saw it for myself. He just blurted it out during the hearing. And so I think that the court has to discount the evidentiary value of that because there was no indication that he had any foundation to be able to make the statement that he made, unless he was standing in the bedroom at the time of the alleged incident.
If to take the chief's hypothetical another step further, take it to the extreme. Under a mediated settlement agreement, a child is being placed in a home where the last 7 children have been injured or attacked or killed, and there's no history of family violence. Must the trial court enforce that MSA? I'm hypothesizing something that is clearly against the child's best interest to see how far your argument actually goes. How far you'll stay with it.
My answer would be yes, but if I were a trial court judge, in my continuing supervisory capacity over the case, I might consider some additional conditions that might serve to protect the child.
Which are not required in the statute.
Which are not required.
Saying placement under that MSA in that house is.
Right. What I'm talking about.
Statutory language.
What I'm talking about is the statute goes to the time, conduct going up to the time of the mediated settlement conference, and then locks in the parent as to what it is that a parent agreed to at the mediated settlement conference through the time of the judgment. that does not take into account any conduct that might occur from the point of judgment after or from the time of the mediated settlement conference after. If the judge, in the judge's continuing supervisory capacity, determines that there's reason to have cause for concern, a judge always has continuing jurisdiction to take other steps to try to ensure the benefit and protection of the child.
On proper motion, most family law judges have thousands of cases on their docket, and they're not necessarily going to know that they need to take additional action. But I want to ask you a question about this concept of absurd results. Does removing the trial court's discretion have the potential to lead to absurd results? I remember at least a couple of cases where both parents were involved in sexual contact with their own child. Now, I can envision where those parents would enter into an MSA, and if the trial court has no discretion to look into that, doesn't that lead to absurd results in that case and in similar cases?
I think that if we are solely talking about the entry of the judgment, yes, but because that trial court judge has the capacity, knowing that that information is present or the potential is present at the time that judgment is entered, can enter additional orders to serve to protect the children.
But what you're saying is the judge shouldn't even ask the best interest question because the judge has no discretion to do anything other than enter a judgment that complies with the agreed to terms in the MSA. And I guess I'm trying to get you to this point. That can lead to absurd results because it would not be uncovered that both of these parents were sleeping with their daughter.
But that is taking this one case in isolation. What I'm suggesting is we've got to look at this the way the legislature looks at it in terms of balancing the public policy in creating the interest to go through mediated settlements to get these cases out of the system early versus protecting the children. Would I necessarily have balanced that point as the father of four children where the legislature did? No.
But we have to construe the statute to avoid absurd results. And what you're suggesting, completely removing the trial court's discretion to look into best interest, can lead to absurd results in many, many circumstances. Yes or no?
Yes, but not doing it will also lead to absurd results, and this is why. The whole point of mediation, the whole reason it's successful in pulling cases out of the system and protecting families is in order to get parties in a situation where they are comfortable, where they can talk without fear of losing confidentiality, where they can disclose matters that occur during the mediation without worrying about them being used later on.
Well, isn't there also a recognition by the legislature that the process of litigation with regard to children and families is harmful to the child?
Absolutely.
And that if a child is in the process of this type of litigation, that in itself is not in the best interest of the child.
Correct. And in fact, that's embodied in Section 154, where the legislature talks about the public policy of the state of doing this in order to protect families and to foster a healing so that the parties can go on with their lives.
Exactly. So the policy reasons behind this are not necessarily to enhance the court's ability to run the docket. It's largely, isn't it, because of the same best interest issue that we are focusing on.
Right. But what I was getting to just now is if we don't do this, if we were to say that in all instances the trial court has the option and opportunity to reject a mediated settlement because it's not in the best interest, it is the likely situation that family lawyers will have to disclose to their clients, yes, you may go to mediation, and yes, they may lock the doors after 11 hours and lock the bathrooms, and you may be tired, but ultimately you get an agreement that you and your former spouse think is in the best interest of the child. You sign this agreement, you're emotionally exhausted, you sleep for 2 days after that, and suddenly one of or the other of you decides, you know, I don't really think this is in my child's best interest. I'm having buyer's remorse. I want to go back on this.
Mr. Rothenberg, can an MSA validly allow visitation or contact with somebody that the parties agree to, but that may be in violation of someone's condition of probation?
No, and this one does not. I want to be clear about that. The gentleman in question is no longer under the terms of his probation, and it would not in this case.
So in a situation was, okay, assume this, because you're arguing, boil down, there's complete autonomy. Parties to an MSA have complete unfettered autonomy, assuming no family violence and the other conditions. But unfettered autonomy to agree to whatever they want to agree to, correct?
Yes.
So if there were a situation where, you know, and again, there's no evidence of family violence or the other kind of trap doors or reasons to get out of the MSA, but if an MSA purported to allow contact with or interaction with somebody who was on probation, and a condition of that probation was no contact with or interaction with, you know, children or this child specifically or something like that, that would not be something parties could agree to in an MSA.
That would be the distinction between an buyer's remorse on one hand versus an illegal agreement on the other hand. And I would never say that a court should sign an order based on illegality, an agreement that's illegal.
Illegality is just sort of kind of presumed kind of in the background of the statute.
Well, no, illegality is presumed in the very term mediated settlement agreement, because the mediated settlement agreement is nothing more than a contract, which is subject to contractual terms, and a contract
can be void for public policy.
Right, but the public policy of the state is stated in two different ways. One, we want these cases mediated. Two, we want to protect children. And the weighing and balancing that goes on is something that the legislature, I'm certain, agonized over, but it's something that if there's any second guessing to be done, I would hope it would be done over the bill filing for next
session.
But
to be clear, a mediated settlement agreement, you're saying implicit in the word mediated is the parties can agree to something that would be otherwise a violation of a court order or some other law.
No, I'm saying you cannot, it can't be illegal and it cannot be fraudulent. And that's implicit in the nature of it being an agreement which has to be, meet the other terms of a contract.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Lawson will present argument for the real party in interest.
My name is Clint Lawson. I represent Benjamin Aretas, the real party in interest in this case. As you've heard, the issue today is whether Judge Sherry Dean clearly abused her discretion at the trial court level in refusing to enter a mediated settlement agreement that was not in the child's best interest. The test for a clear abuse of discretion is whether the trial court acted without reference to any guiding principles or rules, whether the act was arbitrary or unreasonable. In this instance, it was not. What is clear is that Sherry Dean acted to safeguard the environment of the child.
Is it an abuse of discretion to disregard a statute or to rule in contravention of a statute?
Well, it may be, but it has to be a clear abuse of discretion.
Well, is it not a clear abuse of discretion then, if a statute is clear and unambiguous, and a trial court rules in contravention to that statute, is there any time that would not be a clear abuse of discretion for a trial court?
Well, I'm not sure if it would ever, what the situation it ever would be, but in this situation, the statutes are in conflict. So, to answer your question,
one of them has to prevail at some point.
Well, that's correct.
One of them has to prevail.
I believe there is a statutory interpretation that can reconcile the statutes where this situation is not a clear abuse of discretion.
Can I ask you, please, if you were to prevail, wouldn't that prevent people from going to mediation? Because if you're going to have at the motion to enter judgment a hearing basically on best interest, which is a major issue, that's not an easy thing to decide. That takes a lot of evidence to figure out what's in the best interest of a child. And the purpose of mediation being to keep that from happening so that the child doesn't get put in the middle of that litigation, that fight, wouldn't, if you prevail, that just be undermined?
I believe that under limited circumstances, the court would have discretion to reject the entry of an agreement that places a child in danger.
Okay, and tell me, that's what I'm trying to get at. What would those limited situations be, and how do you suggest that we would be able to construe that by reading the statute?
Well, The Strong Public Policy Statements in Chapter 153 as a whole cannot be read and overcome by the isolated provisions set forth in Family Code Section 153.0071, which are more isolated and generalized concerning the entry of a judgment.
But the question is when? Assuming you're right, when? What if the testimony is, I'm afraid there might be sexual harassment? What if the testimony is, well, I'm not even afraid, but, you know, I just know he's a no good person, and I just think inevitably there probably will be.
Well, Your Honor,
in the great spectrum of evidence that you're going to get on what's the best interest.
Your Honor, in this circumstance, there are two facts that are relevant that are undisputed. The first is that the mother of the child knowingly placed the child in the presence of a registered sex offender, and two, that at least on one occasion, the sex offender slept naked with the child.
Well, he said, opposing counsel says that's hearsay. He said that testimony is incompetent.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that's in the record. There was no objection, and I believe it's an undisputed fact at the trial court level.
That somebody actually saw that happen, or that the husband said that it happened?
There was no cross-examination of the father at the trial court level on that issue. So I can't answer your question.
But what short of those circumstances would be enough to set aside the agreement?
Well, certainly evidence of danger would be sufficient to set aside an agreement. And I believe a trial court judge would be granted the discretion to make that determination, as they would be if it was an illegal agreement.
Where do you read that in the statute that the trial judge has discretion? Where's that in the statute?
Well, it's essentially the public policy of the state of Texas in 153.001, which sets forth it's the public policy of the state of Texas to provide for the safe, stable, and nonviolent environment of the child.
153.002 says that the best interest of the child shall always be the primary consideration of the court in determining the issues of conservatorship and possession and access. When the court enters that judgment, is it making a determination when it enters that MSA?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the fact is that 153.002A2, it simply furthers the trial court's role in the public policy stated in 153.001.
So I guess because when you're granting a divorce, you have to make certain findings that the terms and conditions are in the best interest of the children. Is a trial court making those same determinations when it enters a judgment that incorporates an MSA? And if it is, it seems that 153.002 would have paramount relevance.
Well, yes, Your Honor, you're correct. However, if you wanted to apply the rules of statutory construction,
well, I know the other one was later enacted, but I'm talking about the words in 153.002, determining.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that might be, it would be determinative in the fact that it's more specific than simply the best interest provision in 153.0071.
Do we not give any interpretive weight at all to the fact that lawmakers specifically included a best interest exception in the arbitration provision, but for whatever reason, chose not to in the MSA provision? Are you saying the best interest language is just sort of superfluous and redundant there because you've got the overall kind of generic backdrop of best interest? Was it not necessary to put it in the arbitration provision? Or why would it be there but not here? I mean, how do we sort of untangle that? And what merits interpretive weight as we kind of sort through all that?
Your Honor, I believe that the legislature is certainly diligent in their attempt to draft 153.0071, yet that isolated provision in 0071 is a more generalized provision, and it's more isolated in its application. And if you applied to that provision over 153.0071 and 153.002, you would essentially have a partial revocation of 153.001 and 153.002. I'm not sure what the intentions of the legislature were, but I do believe that a safety exception under public policy concerns would be appropriate.
Let me ask you this.
One of them is obviously, you know, you've got an agreement that you're dealing with an MSA, and arbitration, of course, is not an agreement. It's imposed. But with respect to the fact that there is an agreement between the parties, it seems to me that one way to look at this is the statute provides a way of setting aside the agreement if those three factors are laid out. But also, there are other ways of setting aside agreements, as suggested by your other counsel here. If to enforce the agreement is to enforce an illegal act, is it enforce illegal conduct? But in doing so, wouldn't the trial court, in setting aside the MSA, be required somehow to set out the reasons for avoiding the agreement, rather than just simply say, well, I'm not going to enforce it because I don't think it's in the best interest of the child, just generally speaking? Wouldn't there have to be, under the statute, wouldn't there have to be some articulation of the reasons for avoiding the agreement?
Under the statute, I don't believe there's a requirement to do that at this time. Certainly, if this were a final trial, findings of fact could be requested, but this is a mandamus proceeding.
Right. The enforceability, what the trial court did in this instance, refused to enforce the agreement, but just simply from the court's own perspective, just didn't think it was in the best interest of the child.
Right.
And in the face of the statute, it just seems to me that if you're going to ignore that statutory language and the agreement, that you'd have to do more than that.
Well, that may be, but opposing counsel did not request any findings in that regard. And I don't believe that the statute requires the court to make those findings absent a request. Now, there are three.
Counsel, let me ask a question. Opposing, and you may want to respond, opposing counsel suggests that even if the trial court entered this a judgment on this MSA, then the trial court still has discretion to impose conditions on the possession that the mother and her husband would have, that it could be supervised. And as I recall from having read through this, actually they were required to give the father, your client, notice of when and where the visitation was going to occur. And so was the trial court limited in what it could do? Call CPS down right now. I'm going to enter this, but I want you to talk to these people, and I want some supervision. Does the trial court have discretion to do those other things to protect this child?
In the case of Garcia Udall versus Udall, I believe that the Dallas Court of Appeals stated that a trial court has no authority to modify the terms of a mediated settlement agreement. So that would certainly—
Not to modify, but to supervise and to call CPS down and make arrangements and impose some additional requirements between the mother and the and her husband and the child for supervision.
Well, I believe arguably that the imposition of additional safeguards would be a modification of the mediated settlement agreement and would be improper.
How does this necessity for additional safeguards come to the attention of the trial court in this context, absent an inquiry into best interest?
It doesn't.
Otherwise stated, what are the child's rights in this entire scenario when a child has two parents who agree to something that is not in that child's best interest?
Certainly, the public policy of the state of Texas in 153.001 and 002, since 1935, trial courts have been empowered to protect the best interests of children. Global impact of 153.01 and 002 throughout the chapter provides that trial courts have that power to be the gatekeeper of the safety of children.
Okay. Well, that's right, but there are experts, family law experts, that have written to the court as a friend and say essentially what your opposing counsel said, that there are interests here that have to be protected in order for the system to be efficient, for people to want to engage in mediation and get some of these thousands of cases off the court's docket. And You have a specialty in family law as well, or
yes,
you practice that? How do you respond to your colleagues on that point?
Your Honor, I'm board certified in family law. I've been practicing for 16 years. And the practical reality is that a mediated settlement agreement that has circumstances whereby the parents entered into an ill-advised or a mistaken mediated settlement agreement are few and seldom. This is the first time in 16 years that I've come across the unique facts of this case. The argument of the family law counsel and opposing counsel in referencing thousands of cases that this will impact, I believe, is incorrect. I believe the limited facts of a safety-related or dangerous mediated settlement agreement are just that.
Should it be only limited to children? Let's say, what would your answer be if it just involved property and no children were involved? Can an MSA be torn apart then? I know that's not your case, but.
Your Honor, I can't see a circumstance where an issue regarding property would be.
Well, opposing counsel said that it just falls under standard contract law. There's always defenses to a contract.
Well, the provisions in 153.0071 are not exclusive. They are subject to contract provisions, fraud, duress, coercion, illegality, and based upon my interpretation, the public policy of the safety of a child, placing the child in a dangerous situation.
Ms. Let me ask you this. The statute says that this mediated settlement agreement is they're entitled to entry of that order, notwithstanding any other law. What do you think that the legislature meant by any other law?
That's an excellent question. It appears from the reading of the statute that it limits the court to the provisions contained in 153.0071. However, that would be in conflict with the provisions for illegality, fraud, duress, and coercion.
Well, they had to have been thinking of something.
Yes, sir. I agree. I'm not sure what that is.
Would it seems to me that the only thing it could apply to would be, since they're talking about it, is the best interest requirement.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a reasonable interpretation. However, if you wanted to analyze a more specific and directive provision, 153.001A2, specifically speaks to the public policy to provide children with a safe, stable, and nonviolent environment. This court in Holly v. Adams has provided a long list of considerations used in determining a child's best interest, including one of the factors, which would be in this case, is the danger to the child now and in the future, which clearly is a safety-related issue, which clearly makes 153.001A2, a much more specific public policy statement than the best interest, the more isolated but yet generalized best interest provision in 153.0071.
So in adopting your rule and in trying to provide trial courts with guidance on what type of inquiry they should conduct at an MSA hearing, how deep into the Holly factors should a court inquire in order to make a best interest determination, because that's the subject of 7-week trials. So how would you instruct a trial court to proceed in these circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that they would, under my analysis and interpretation to reconcile the three statutes, I believe the court would be limited to the safe, stable, and nonviolent environment of the child.
Would that be whether a motion was made to revoke or withdraw the agreement on behalf of one party, or does the trial court have an independent duty to examine every one of these, or how does the trial court, as Justice Guzman alluded to a moment ago, how does the trial court find out about this, or do they have to inquire sua sponte?
Well, I believe that Justice Guzman was correct when she stated that trial court judges have thousands of cases, and I think that it would be incumbent upon the attorneys to file an appropriate motion. Otherwise, I don't believe that the courts have the resources to conduct this kind of an inquiry in every single case.
But that doesn't address the real issue that I have with this, and that's two parents and their counsel who act in a concerted effort against a child's best interest. They're never going to bring it up to the court. So if we're going to say that a court has discretion to make a best interest inquiry, I guess I'm trying to get to how broad should that inquiry be and how many Holly factors should the court consider? You have to assume that the parties aren't interested in protecting the child.
Well, certainly today there is no duty for the court to conduct a best interest analysis on a mediated agreement, I don't believe, not compelled to, although they're authorized to. They are compelled to under 153.0071. As I stated before, the safe, stable, and nonviolent environment would be the consideration. And
you said a minute ago that this is the exception, that this would be the exceptional case.
Yes.
And it sounds to me like the test that you're setting forth right now would not be exceptional, that would be in every case, because safety is certainly a very large component of best interest.
Well, I certainly think that safety is a large component of best interest, but yet I think that the application in revoking a mediated agreement would seldom occur. It's counterintuitive that parents act, one parent would act in an unsafe manner to their child. It's something that generally doesn't occur in the population. It does occur periodically, but I don't believe that it occurs as frequently as opposing counsel would represent.
Looking back, do you think lawmakers just made a drafting error with 0071 by using and instead of or?
I do.
And if you believe that, if you believe that they just messed up, I mean, what kind of recourse does that give us? Do we just simply alert the legislature to the error and exhort or invite them to fix it when they reconvene in a few months? Or do we follow the words they used, however inadvertent they might have been?
Your Honor, I see my time is coming to a close.
You may answer that, please.
Thank you. I believe the proper approach presently is to provide a exception for the placing a child in danger. I believe that there was a drafting error in the legislation. The reality is that if the relief that my client is requesting is not granted, we still have a mediated agreement that places the child in danger. Certainly Judge Dean and any other Harris County family law judge under similar circumstances would likely make the same ruling that she made.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
One other question. Did you attend the mediated settlement conference?
I did, Your Honor.
Court will hear a rebuttal.
It pleases the court. It seems as though what we've been focusing on is fixing a situation after a mediated settlement agreement is entered when we have a concern that the parties may not be acting in the best interest of the child. I would suggest there's a much better remedy which preserves the ability of the thousands of typical cases to go through mediated settlements and get those judgments entered, and that would be inserting an attorney early in the case if the court has any concern or belief based upon the facts of the case that there's reason to believe that both parents won't act in the best interest of the child, whether by criminal background or evidence or otherwise. And before the mediation is scheduled or allowed to go forward, the court appoints, and forgive me for not knowing the correct term, an attorney ad litem or guardian ad litem, someone in addition to the parents, because there's a potential conflict between the child and the parents, to participate in that mediation and to look out for the children's best interest and not to allow the mediated settlement agreement to be entered unless that person is confident and comfortable that the parties, the parents, are in fact acting in the best interest of the child.
Well, and that also, conversely, certainly gives the trial court more comfort in the scope of its best interest inquiry. There's an ad litem, and so that gives more comfort, but that's not always the case. But I guess my question to you is, does the trial court determine best interest when it enters an MSA in accordance with 153.002?
If the legislature amends 153.0071, then yes. Otherwise,
well,
I believe no.
It says the child's best interest shall always be the primary consideration in determining possession and access and conservatorship. Is there a determination made when the trial judge signs their name to that judgment?
No, because the legislature said specifically shall be entitled. It doesn't say the party may ask the court for or may petition for.
Don't all those decrees have language that say the court finds that the following orders are in the best interest of the children? I mean, first it says the parties agreed. Then the court makes a finding in all of those orders that says it's in the best interest of the children. So how does the court make that finding, just based on what you agreed to in the MSA? Or how does it, I mean, what supports that finding?
I think the legislature's determination that the parents in the vast majority of the cases act in the best interest of their children, which is why the legislature created a dichotomy between the arbitration cases with an arbitration award by someone who is not a parent versus the parents who enter into the mediated settlement agreement, who are presumed by the legislature to act in the children's best interest.
But going forward, should trial courts delete that finding from all of its orders? Because certainly if the trial court is going to sign its name to it, I find that the following orders are in the children's best interest, there ought to be some kind of inquiry. So should from now on, after, if we adopt your rule, do they have to delete that language?
I think the legislature has told the trial courts that if the parents both come to the court and in the mediated settlement agreement represent, as they did in this case, it's actually written into the mediation settlement agreement that they both agree that this agreement is in the child's best interest, that is prima facie evidence to support the trial court's finding of best interest.
Trial court cannot inquire any further into the basis for their agreement.
Simply because the legislature used the word shall be entitled. I believe that's correct. So by inserting an attorney to represent the children's interest before the mediation, we take care of all of the problems here. We make sure the children's interests are protected. We get the benefit in the thousands and thousands of cases where these agreements aren't sought to be abrogated, of getting those cases through the system quickly, efficiently, and with minimum harm to the children.
But that usually doesn't come up until, that usually doesn't come up, does it, until the mediated settlement agreement is said to be entered and somebody challenges it. Nobody knows.
I'm suggesting that in order to avoid the hundreds of hours potentially, we were talking about a 7-week trial on some of these good, you know, best interest inquiries, in order to avoid that kind of burden on the system, there's no harm in a trial court before it enters an order sending a case to a mediated settlement conference in saying, parents, come on down. I want to spend 15, 20 minutes with y'all, and I want to ask you some questions about your backgrounds and about your involvement with the kids. And if the court is confident that those parents, based on those appearances, that the parents are acting in the children's best interest, can allow those parents to continue going forward and acting solely on the kids' best interest themselves. And if not, they insert a lawyer. If they say, aha, you know, something just doesn't seem right here, what's the harm? The minimal intrusion of an additional lawyer in a mediation for one day compared to weeks and months of further litigation in a case, it seems like a no-brainer.
Sounds like you're agreeing that best interest has to drive this determination, whether it is before the settlement, mediated settlement agreement happens, or after it.
No, Your Honor. As a lawyer who is looking at the legislation, I am telling this court with a straight face, straight out, I believe that because of the way this statute is written, the legislature intended that best interest not be a consideration except as between the parents. I'm suggesting that the 9 members of this court and myself be the first 10 people online at bill filing time and saying, legislature, we want you to look at this because we're concerned about it. But as a parent, as Scott Rothenberg, the parent of a 12-year-old, I'm saying I have no problem with the court asking another lawyer to come in and say, I want you to kind of look this over and eyeball these folks and make sure that these parents are.
We would write an opinion that would require trial courts to get the counsel of an ad litem before sending a case to mediated settlement agreement?
The court could instruct through a suggestion in the opinion. The court could order it as a mandatory step. I think trial courts, you know, are afforded action, and I think there's opportunity to suggest to trial courts not only.
So in this case, opinion, we'd send it back down to the trial court, order the trial court to get an ad litem to look at the child's best interest.
No, Your Honor, because the statute is what the statute is, and I believe it says what it says, and I believe the legislature intended exactly what it meant. The reason I think that is because this past session there was an effort to change the statute, a bill was filed to amend it, and it didn't pass. They had the opportunity if they wanted to.
Justice Lehrman.
I just have one question. Please. To follow up on the chief, and that is with regard to the necessity or our requiring the appointment of an ad litem being an attorney, isn't it true that social studies are often conducted in these cases, and that would serve the same type of to accomplish what you're talking about?
Absolutely. I'm speaking generically about a child advocate, and if I was using a term of art when I said attorney ad litem or guardian ad litem, I meant generally a responsible adult who's outside the parents in a case where the court has reason to believe or reason for concern that they might be acting in the children's best interest.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Rothenberg and Mr. Lawson. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.